I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hello everyone, and welcome to this Dante event. I'll introduce all of us quite quickly. So I myself am a translator from Russian, Robert Chandler. I learned Italian when I was about 20, precisely in order to read Dante. And so I've known Dante about 45 years and David about 40 years. And I've been following David's translation over the last few years, been reading it canto by canto as he's read it. Dante himself was born in 1265, and he died 700 years ago on the 14th of September, 1321. That's part of the reason for this date. Very few facts about his life. His mother died before he was 10. He met Beatrice, his muse, at the age of 9, and claims to have fallen in love with her at first sight. He was involved with Florentine politics, and he ended up being exiled, so he spent a long time in exile, and he wrote his Divine Comedy in exile. Three parts to it, so it's a journey down to the depths of hell, through purgatory, where sinners repent from their sins and are eventually freed and able to ascend and eventually go up to paradise, which is the last part. So Giovanna is a psychoanalyst. She's written about Dante. David is a poet and a psychoanalyst, and also with a background in philosophy. David and Giovanna and David's wife and someone else have all been part of a little reading group, reading Dante in Italian during the last few years. And Giovanna has also written an article about identity, which is to be published, Identity in Dante, which is to be published in a book about identity. And she writes very well about Dante's total loss of identity during the kind of crisis, which is obviously partly to do with him being exiled, but that may only be very much a part of it. But in any case, a kind of total loss of identity, a loss of his poetic identity, a loss of his moral identity, and of his political identity. And she writes very well about how gradually he recovers all three of those identities in the course of the Divine Comedy. So, Giovanna, you've written very movingly about what it meant to you this translation, this new translation of the Purgatory. So would you like to just read that page that you've written?
Yes. Thank you very much, Robert. It is a privilege for me to be part of this event. With David, Juliet Newbegin, and Matt Hoffman, we have read Purgatorio alongside David's translation. And I found that my instinctive reluctance towards any translation of Dante faded as David's painstaking work helped me to appreciate the depth of Dante's thinking. David's translation of Purgatory is a gift to the English-speaking readership, and even to those who, like me, tread between two cultures, two languages. It was fascinating to observe how enriching it is to tolerate the difficult and at times frustrating path in between two cultures, two languages, as different aspects are noticed, compared, and shared. This fosters a complex, never easy work of integration between people from different cultural backgrounds. Furthermore, David keeps firmly in mind with Dante the poet, Dante the philosopher, and the politician. These aspects of Dante are of great interest to him, and this is interesting as sometimes these aspects are kept in separate compartments. If kept together as David aimed at, the comedy never ceases to marvel us. And it is truly amazing that in this occasion of the 700th anniversary, Dante is rediscovered as an incredibly modern thinker by many scholars and writers. There is no doubt that, as with all great poetry, when Dante's canto is lyrical and sublime, is untranslatable. However, when Dante's desire for reasoning, learning, and teaching takes priority, such as in several parts of Purgatory or even more so in Paradise, I found David's translation truly original and poetic. I think that it is the extraordinary beauty of Dante's poetry and the depth of his knowledge of the human mind and its potential for psychic development that makes the comedy truly divine and of great interest to psychoanalysts. Boccaccio, having read La Commedia, added the adjective divine to Dante's chosen title. And it is incredible that that adjective divine has remained. And since then, we call Dante's masterpiece La Divina Commedia. David's impressive work expresses his love for what Jorge Luis Borges defined as the best book literature has ever achieved. David's desire to follow Dante step by step as he climbs the mountain of Purgatory is truly commendable. David's commentary and translation enrich the reading of Purgatory, combining his own original personal thoughts while simultaneously mindful of wanting to remain as close as possible to Dante's extraordinary mind. I am sure that the book, with its fine editing, will motivate and facilitate readers to enjoy the original poetry before grasping the meaning, or to enjoy the translation before tackling the original, shifting attention from the right page of his book to the left one, and vice versa. Lastly, I want to add the obvious, but it can be easily taken for granted. David's translation is not only about finding the meaning. It is the result of a lengthy process of comprehension and digestion of the original text with what it really evoked in him as the reader. Thank you, David, for your amazing work.
Thank you,
Giovanna. Thank you, Giovanna. I want to just pick up on two little things there. Firstly, the mention of Borges. It is quite extraordinary the number of really the very greatest poets of the last century to whom Dante has been enormously important. though Pound, Eliot, Borges, Beckett, Joyce, Mantale, the Russian poets Akhmatovan, Mandelstam, the Armenian poet Cherence, all of them absolutely revered Dante. And the other word, Giovanna used the word development. There always have been more readers for the Inferno because of a few of the dramatic anthology pieces in the Inferno. But it is the purgatory where people actually develop. It's the purgatories where people change. In hell, everyone is fixed in their despair. In paradise, they're fixed in their bliss. In purgatory, they're changing. And that's what makes quite a lot of people actually think that the purgatory is the most satisfying whole, more than the Inferno or the Paradiso. And of course, it's that development, that sense of people developing and struggling with their inner conflicts that is a large part of what makes the purgatory especially interesting to psychoanalysts. So, David, something I haven't actually ever asked you before is, when did you first read Dante, and what was the very first sort of moment, the first part of Dante that really, really sort of made an impact on you?
Before I start answering that question, I would just like to thank you both, Robert and Giovanna, for your introductions, and Giovanna, a very handsome description of the translation, which I hope it deserves. When did I first get interested? I'm really not sure what the answer to that is. I think I've always been, you know, as long as I can remember, which is quite a long time now, I think always been rather haunted by the thought of this Italian poet who, throughout his career, was trying to understand ever more deeply what his feelings for this girl, Beatrice Portinari, what his feelings really meant. And he wasn't content to, as it were, make some simple explanation of them. He knew that there was something there that was of simply enormous importance. So I think I've had a sense of that for, you know, as long as I can remember in my adult life. And in a number of poems of my own, I've made sort of glancing references to Dante, going back certainly till the 1980s. But what kindled it specifically more recently was that a friend of mine, who actually has been mentioned already by Giovanna, Matt Hoffman, suddenly suggested to me, I don't know why he suggested it, he suggested that I might be interested in going to the Warburg Institute to hear lectures that were being given on Dante by two well-known Dante scholars, Alessandro Scafi and John Took. And that must have been something like 9 or 10 years ago, I think, now. And I went along to them and was immediately more deeply interested and engaged by what I was discovering. And it was soon after that, I think it was about 2013, 2014, I started thinking that there's something about the energy of Dante's writing, which is very extraordinary and very unlike anything in English language poetry that I was aware of. A continual movement of the thinking mind. He would be describing something which might be, in Inferno certainly, might be grotesque or horrible, or it might be funny, or it might be a bit tedious, but his mind was always at work asking himself the question, what's going on now? What does this mean? What exactly is it? So I think that was the thing that intrigued me. And I found when I just read the canto, I moved too quickly. I needed to go slowly and discover what was going on in the individual uses of his language, so to speak. And so I started translating one or two cantos from Purgatorio and one or two from Paradiso in an attempt just to discover what was going on more accurately, so to speak.
I'll just say at that point that a friend and colleague with whom I've often collaborated, a Russian-American woman, Professor Olga Meyerson, she is primarily a scholar, but she has done some, she describes herself as a literary theorist, but she has done some translation and on her own and some with me. And she very often repeats that the unique thing about translation is that it forces you to think about every sentence of the original. Whereas if you're a scholar or a critic or a literary historian, you can pick and choose. You can write about the bits that you immediately feel comfortable with or find easy to understand. And you know, you just don't sort of think about some awkward bits or bits that just don't immediately mean a lot to you. And as a translator, you have to deal with everything. And quite often you will find that bits that didn't initially mean very much to you suddenly do become very important. So I absolutely understand that. And any activity that really sort of forces you to do something, you know, whether it's directing a play or acting in a play or setting a play into music, translating it into another language, anything like that, it sort of obviously brings you into much, much more meaningful relationship with the original work.
Mm.
The question that's just been asked is whether you're about Terza Rima, Dante's intricate rhyming pattern, and whether or not you'd like to say anything about translations, other translations which have or haven't used it, whether you ever considered using it, and so on.
I really never considered, I mean, obviously the thought crossed my mind, but I never seriously considered using it myself. Partly for the reason I was just pointing to, that I think the movement of the thought in Dante is so careful and so skillful that was what I wanted to follow, and to try to bring in rhyme I think would have been an immense distraction, and rhymes are anyway scarcer in English than they are in Italian. People sometimes say it's rather easy to find rhymes in Italian. I'm not sure if that's actually true, but I think it's certainly easier than it is in English. But I've, also one of my difficulties in answering this question is that I've avoided looking at verse translations of Purgatorio over the last few years because I didn't want to be excessively influenced by other people. I have used prose translations extensively and found them very helpful, but I didn't want to read verse translations. But I have looked at the Dorothy Sayers translation, which does indeed use Terza Rima in English. And I thought very highly of it, actually. It's got a lot of old-fashioned poetic diction, sort of meseems and so forth in it. So it reads like, you know, poetic poetry of the sort that nobody now wants to read, probably. But it's actually a pretty good translation. And she was a very intelligent reader of Dante. She gets a lot of his meaning in spite of using the Terza Rima. So I think that's the only one I would care to comment on.
Yes, I mean, I totally disagree with you there. I can't stand reading the Dorothy Sayre. I find it, I don't doubt her intelligence as a reader, but I do feel the rhymes pull her off course all the time. But with regard to your own translation, I think it is worth pointing out that you clearly do, you do see each three-line unit, each tercet, as a kind of a structural unit of Dante's thinking. And even though you don't actually keep the rhymes, you do very much, you know, in your translation, the sense of the three-line units, you know, is present.
Yes, I tried to keep the sense. Sorry?
That's a part of the sort of step-by-step movement of the thing.
Yes, I tried to keep the tercet as a unit, and to quite an extent to keep the individual line as a unit, because I think the actual sequence in which Dante introduces his thought or his imagery often has a power which one loses if one takes it back into perhaps a more natural English sentence. Though sometimes I was working with something that feels quite sort of tense to me to match the movement of Dante's, the sequence of Dante's thought. I remember T.S. Eliot writes a passage in Four Quartets, which is a sort of imitation of Dante. It's the passage where he describes being a fire warden in London after a bombing raid, a very, very skillful passage. He said it was the most difficult thing he had ever written. And he doesn't use terza rima, but he does alternate iambic pentameters with feminine endings, that's to say with one additional unstressed syllable at the end of the line, with iambic pentameters without feminine endings. And that's a very skillful compromise, it seems to me, between the struggle to find rhyme, which is too difficult, but nevertheless keeping something of the alternating line quality that
Dante absolutely has. yes. Something I'd like to ask myself is, Dante has two guides on his journey. So Virgil guides him down through hell and up through all the terraces of purgatory, up to the earthly paradise, which is on the very top of Mount Purgatory. And at that point, Beatrice appears, and Virgil, very suddenly, to Dante's dismay, disappears. And Beatrice guides him, questions him rather severely in the earthly paradise, and then guides him up through the different spheres of the paradise. Why these two guides, and what is the role of each of them? How do they differ? Why did Dante need two different guides?
It's a very good question, and it's a huge question, I think. But it's certainly a very, very crucial point about what Dante is doing. I think one of the things, Giovanna mentioned that Dante's comedy, as he always called it, has got this adjective added to it by Boccaccio, divine comedy. And I think people sometimes think of the comedy as divine, as almost as if it's kind of holy writ. But in fact, it's twofold. Eric Auerbach described Dante as poet of the secular world, which I think is also wrong. But Dante actually keeps a most extraordinary balance between the secular world the ordinary world and the world of religion. And again, Giovanna mentioned the way it's easy to compartmentalize Dante and talk about him as if, you know, he's getting revenge on his political enemies, or he's only really interested in Christian salvation. But really, he is very, very interested in the fullness of life. And so I think, I mean, the language I've used when I've been writing about Dante is that the two guides represent two ethical levels. And Virgil represents the whole classical world, the world of classical thought, which was just coming, or Aristotle's thought, was just coming into the awareness of Christian theologians in the 12th and 13th centuries. It was translated, fascinating story, it had been translated into Arabic, preserved by Muslim scholars, and in the 12th century, it was translated, a lot of it out of Arabic into Latin, and became accessible to Western thinkers again.
Is Aristotle?
Aristotle.
Yeah.
And that kind of classical philosophy made a huge impact on serious Christian theologians, Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas in particular, and then on Dante. And so one way of thinking of Virgil and Beatrice is that Virgil represents the wisdom of the classical world, which Dante greatly respected and saw as having all kinds of practical knowledge about how one should behave. And Beatrice represents the wisdom that is derived from the Christian revelation. And Dante never doubts that that is a higher thing than the classical world's knowledge. And it's Beatrice who sends Virgil to Dante's rescue. And Virgil's entire project is to bring Dante back up purgatory to re-meet Beatrice. So he never doubts the primacy, so to speak, of Beatrice, but he is absolutely persuaded, and he says very clearly in the comedy, and he also says it in his prose work, De Monarchia, he says very clearly that we need two suns, S-U-N-S, two suns to illuminate the path of life, both the practical wisdom that Aristotle represents, which results in virtues like justice and truth-telling and friendship and all sorts of excellent things, but also the other level that Beatrice represents, which is what he would call divine love, and what I've tended to suggest in things I've tried to write about Dante, is the love of being rather than the love of doing, the love of somebody for their being, which creates, I suppose a psychoanalyst would talk about it as maternal love, the sort of love we like to think mothers have for their babies and small children, where they just love them for their being, whatever they do. And this is an enormously important component of psychic health, as I think we in the psychoanalytic world are very aware, and perhaps increasingly aware as time continues. Sorry, I'm talking too much. Giovanna, I feel you should come in.
Well, I think it's actually a good point, since we're talking about the shift from one guide to the other, and that you should both read. So would you like to read the passage from the very top of Mount Purgatory, David, and then Giovanna will read it in Italian after you?
Right. Yep. Okay. Well, just to tell the audience, we agreed in advance that we would read a chunk of the actual poem, and it's the moment, as Robert says, at the summit of, well, at the top of the terraces, the moment when Dante and Virgil have emerged from the final terrace, and all sins are now repented, so to speak. They have slept, and Dante has had a dream. And whenever Dante has a dream in purgatory, you know that he's going to wake up in a new moral world, so to speak, a new psychological world. So he's had a dream, and a new phase of the story is about to begin. And they approach the final stairway, and Virgil tells Dante that today will bring peace to all your yearnings. And Dante is enormously pleased to hear this. So they get onto the stairway. So much my longings piled upon each other to be above, that at each step I felt my wings grow stronger on me for the flight. When the whole stairway had been quickly put beneath us, and we'd reached the topmost step, my teacher Virgil fixed his eyes on mine and said, "My son, you've seen now both the temporal and the eternal fires, and you have reached where I myself can now discern no further. I have brought you here by thoughtfulness and skill. Henceforth, let your own pleasure be your guide. You have come beyond the steep and rocky pathways. Now see the sun that shines upon your forehead. Now see the grass, the flowers, and the trees that earth here brings forth solely from herself. Until those lovely eyes come and are joyful," this is Beatrice's eyes, "until those lovely eyes come and are joyful, whose weeping caused me first to visit you, you may sit down or walk about among them. No longer look to me for word or signal. Your will is straight now, vigorous and free. It would be sin to act against its wisdom. You over yourself I therefore crown and mitre."
Thank you very much, David. I was delighted when the two of you chose that passage, because it is one of my favourite passages and one that I know by heart and often repeat to myself. So, Giovanna, I'd love to hear it in Italian too, and sure the audience wants to hear that as well. So please read yourself.
Thank you. Tanto voler sopravoler mi venne dell'esser su, che ad ogni passo poi al volo mi sentia crescer le penne. Come la scala tutta sotto noi fu corsa e fummo in sul grado superno, in me ficcò Virgilio gli occhi suoi e disse: "Il temporal foco e l'eterno veduto hai, figlio, e se venuto in parte dov'io per me più oltre non discerno. Tratto t'ho qui con ingegno e con arte, lo tuo piacere ormai prendi perduce. Fuor sei dell'erte vie, fuor sei dell'arte. Vedi lo sol che in fronte ti riluce, vedi le erbette, i fiori e gli arbuscelli che qui la terra sol da sé produce, mentre che vegna lieti gli occhi belli che lagrimando a te venir mi fenno, sederti puoi e poi andar tra elli. Non aspettare mio dir più, né mio cenno. Libero, dritto e sano è tuo arbitrio, e fallo fora non fare a suo senno, perch'io te sovra te corono e mitrio.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Really, I felt very strongly listening to that. How, at the same time as all that David has said about the movement and structure of Dante's thought, but also how vividly the sense of a speaking voice is present in the verse, even with all the complexity of the form and the time gap of 700 years, you really can hear the intonations of a living voice, and they're not just being sort of superimposed by Giovanna, they really do come from the words themselves.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
So, perhaps I'll ask a question that Josh Reed asked a little while ago. David, why did you choose the Purgatorio when so many translators start with the Inferno? I think Merwin is the only other translator to only do the Purgatorio. So, David.
Oh. Well, that's very interesting. I hadn't even thought of that, whether anybody else had only done the Purgatorio. But the reason I chose it is what I think Robert and Giovanna probably both pointed to, that it is the most psychological of the three canticles. It's the only one in which psychic conflict is the primary player, so to speak. And of course, Dante puts it in a sort of Christian language that it's about repentance. But when you look into what is actually going on each of the terraces of purgatory, and each of them has the label of a rather simple sounding sin, pride, envy, wrath, whatever. But when you look into them, you discover that actually these are very complex motives. And Dante is well aware that there are elements to do with pride and elements to do with wrath. Envy is perhaps the most questionable of them, but elements to do with all these different so-called sins, which are in fact very positive and part of living a full and adequate life. And so there is a lot of psychological discussion, both on the surface of the poem and also implicit within the poem. So all that really grabbed my attention. So that's my reason for choosing Purgatorio and not starting with Inferno.
And something I've said myself a few times with regard to David's work is that a great many psychoanalysts, they kind of use their psychoanalytic understanding in order to supposedly tell us about, tell us a sort of inside story about the writer himself. And this can be rather irritating and condescending. And what's very valuable about David's commentary, which I do think is quite remarkable, his afterword, is that he's using his psychological knowledge to understand the work better. Not to read back into Dante's psyche, but to understand better what Dante has written. A very simple question.
Could I just respond to that, though, Robert? Because I think in order to understand the work, one does actually need to look into Dante's biography a bit. So I do bring Dante, the person, into my account quite a lot, I think.
Sure. But you're not in the kind of superior position of an analyst, sort of telling us what the real reason for somebody writing something is. A simple question, which I've been asked, come up twice. Which canto is it that the two of you read from? Is it canto what number canto is it?
27.
27. Yes.
It's towards the end of canto 27. Okay.
Perhaps one could say that is a prelude. It's a wonderful prelude to Virgil's disappearance. And yes. I think it is such an interesting way of preparing Dante for the disappearance. But actually, you can never prepare anyone for your disappearance. Mm-hmm. But it's so moving. And it gives you such an idea of Virgil as a full person. It's incredible. I think we get so fond of Virgil in his maternal and paternal attitude towards Dante, both through hell and through purgatory, that some people actually burst to tears when he actually disappears. And it is true, you begin to know the person, the full person of this guide, in a way, which is exceptional, really. Mm. We can also say that it is Dante saying goodbye to Virgil and say, he has done his job and now I have to move on.
There's also a special poignancy that yes. Virgil, being a classical figure living before Christ, has no hope of going to paradise. His fate is to go back to limbo.
But I think I don't read it as literally as you do, actually. I think more that Dante got from him what he could, you know? And now he has to move on into Christianity because he had already paid a great deal of tribute to classical culture, in a way. And I think he wants to move on to the founders of the church and all the rest of it in paradise. So I would think that the hopeless Virgil that he can never reach, you know, I think I accept that, but I never actually quite sympathized with it.
You never sympathized
with the idea that basically of looking at Virgil as somebody who is barred from reaching the height of paradise.
Right.
I accept that, but I would take another interpretation of it somehow.
Uh-huh.
As standing for classical culture, from which Dante learned an awful lot. And I think that, again, as well as with Christianity, but somehow the use of mythology, the use of Virgil's mind, I think is so interestingly united to the other, to the journey to come. And I think it's lovely, but also because purgatory is about loss. I mean, let's not be mistaken, there is loss in paradise too, but that is another huge chapter. But I think that what is interesting in purgatory is that it feels real to us because there is loss, as opposed to the eternity of joining and fusion with evil, or the joining and fusion with goodness in paradise. So that's why purgatory, I feel, feels so real to us, because there is loss, there is awareness of the passage of time, There is, you know, a sadness and nostalgia even. Wow.
Yes, enormously. I mean, loss and conflict. And I think an enormous sadness when he meets Beatrice and he realizes how much of his life has been spoiled by his, what he describes as his infidelity to Beatrice. But I think there are many ways of thinking about that.
Yes.
But there's a dreadful sadness when he encounters Beatrice initially. Very, very psychologically subtle change when the two of them meet.
Yeah.
And very, very unexpected, because it's a sort of long-awaited meeting that should be a moment of amazing joy, and actually it's deeply painful.
But again, that is very psychologically meaningful, because Bowlby also told us what happens when children are separated from the parents and they are reunited. There is always something very, very difficult to cope with, and a great deal of resentment and anger.
Yes.
Which has to go to get through and negotiated, as it happens to Dante, you know, in that particular passage. Yeah.
Thank you. Another question from John Jeeve or Geeve. Are you going to translate the other parts, David?
Well, thank you for the idea. Curiously enough, I've never felt any impulse to translate Inferno, apart from perhaps the first few cantos of it. Paradiso, I'm sort of holding my response to at the moment. I'm not sure. I'm very fascinated by Paradiso as well, but for the moment, I feel I'm resting on Purgatoria.
And there's been a question from Nicola Liu about the sin of pride. Is it the most terrible in the comedy? Is pride a two-edged sword for Dante?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It is the fundamental sin in Dante's picture of sins. It's the lowest of the seven terraces. And the importance of humility, the opposite of pride, is emphasized right throughout Purgatory, right at the very beginning, when Dante is girdled with a reed, and we are given a picture of these rushes that grow in the soft mud, bowing to every wind. You couldn't have a stronger plant growing there, because it's necessary to bow with every wind. Which is a symbol of humility and a symbol of the willingness to learn, which is what I think the terraces of Purgatory are primarily about. They represent a kind of training process. But whether it's a two-edged sword is, I think, a very interesting question, because when Dante is talking about pride with Odorici, the manuscript illuminator who he meets on that terrace, he discusses Giotto, his contemporary Giotto, and Cimabue, who was a bit earlier, and he talks about how the fame of these different artists has eclipsed each other. And then he quite surprisingly refers to someone who may be about to eclipse the existing poets. And he is, of course, referring to himself. But it seems to me he's implying the ambiguity of pride, because pride is regarded as a sin in the Christian tradition, and rightly so, and so much of what we tend to call narcissism is covered, in fact, by that notion of pride. But actually, self-respect is a very, very important thing, and nobody would ever undertake the sorts of works that Giotto did and the sort of work that Dante is doing in front of us, writing the comedy, unless they had pretty good self-respect and recognition of their own talent and ability. So, two-edged sword, yes, I think it is a two-edged sword, but then perhaps all these sins are two-edged swords.
Yeah, can I say something to what you are just saying now, David? Because in Italian, superbia, pride, has got exactly what you are talking about, a good positive connotation and not a very good one. But superbia in Italian is arrogance. It's feeling superior to everybody else.
Mm.
So it has got a different connotation compared to the word pride. And you quite correctly say there is a very important aspect of pride, which has to do to value something that you have in yourself and not to despise it or regard it. But superbia, I think, is closer to what we are talking about when we talk about sins.
We talk about arrogance, yes, yes.
Yeah. And there's a kind of paradox here with regard to the work of a translator, because on the one hand, if you're translating anything at all difficult,
yes,
absolutely have to be humble and be ready to ask questions, because there's going to be so many things of, you know, in this case, medieval theology or God knows what, you know, thousands of subjects that you can't possibly be an expert on all these subjects yourself. And as a translator, one can always sort of kid oneself that one's brought the meaning through when actually the meaning isn't clear to anyone else. So humility is absolutely crucial in the work of a translator. And yet at the same time, God, you know, how arrogant must one be to imagine that one can recreate Pushkin or Dante in another language. You know, so you do have to have an extraordinary degree of nerve on the one hand and of humility at the same time. And, you know, translators who lack one of those inevitably are going to fail. You know, there are some translators who think they do know everything and don't ask any questions, and that's a disaster. Or, you know, the alternative is sort of the opposite is, oh well, you know, this is just, you know, one was always going to be lost in translation, and this is only a translation, and so on, and they don't aim high enough in the first place, and the result isn't very interesting.
So I could make a comment to the audience at this point that Robert, who has just spoken, knows what he's talking about, because he's the translator of Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate and Stalingrad, two gigantic projects.
Thank you, David. A related question that Neil Morgan asked a long time ago, what do you think the relationship is between being a translator of Dante's language and being a psychoanalyst, a translator of a person?
Well, again, a very interesting question. I think Dante's allegory, and I wouldn't necessarily say this about anyone else's allegory, but allegory in Dante's hands seems to me a most extraordinary instrument. And I find myself thinking of it, you know, Freud uses the phrase, the language of dreams. And I think there's a spontaneous way in which the psyche communicates with itself, which we meet in dreams, and occasionally we meet in spontaneous metaphors and so forth when we're speaking. And Dante, in his allegory, seems to have found a way to make a conscious use of that language of dream. So it's a very different sort of thing, a very different sort of language from the kind of objective language in which psychoanalysts talk about the psyche. And yet it manages to convey, perhaps even more appropriately sometimes than that objective language, it manages to convey the sort of things we are trying to get at and detect and put into words as psychoanalysts. So I think there really is a very interesting correlation between the sort of translating one is doing when one's working with Dante and the work of an analyst.
There's another question that was asked quite early on this evening, which probably links to that. I've read Professor Black's commentary and appreciate his psychoanalytic reading of Purgatorio, making the unconscious conscious. But I wonder whether at least this part of the poem might also commemorate the journey from literal to metaphoric thought, and thus the birth of a poet. Quite a complex question, which
I've been
able to give a quick answer to, but a very interesting.
Yes, very, very interesting question. I didn't quite follow it there, because it seems to suggest that literal thought precedes metaphorical thought, and my intuition goes the other way. Did I misunderstand it?
No, you didn't misunderstand it. That is your answer, really. But
Yes.
The metaphoric thought comes first.
I think we've lost an awful lot. Freud was fond of describing himself as an Enlightenment thinker. But I think we lost an awful lot with the Enlightenment and with the gradual move towards so-called rationality and scientific thought, not in any way to disparage those, but that there was a huge resource in the more spontaneous metaphorical thought, which in the past has given birth to religions. There's an enormous discussion to be had about what has happened to language since the days when the religions arose, the so-called axial era before the time of Christ, and the movement on. This is just such a gigantic topic. I'm not sure that I can get into it in two or three sentences. But there was a big change. I mean, it was even happening in Dante's lifetime. Apparently, by the end of his life, his work was already beginning to seem old-fashioned, because there was a new current flowing in theology, primarily, which was wanting to push the classical and the Aristotelian influence out of it again, and to declare that you couldn't know anything about God and religious reality from looking at nature. This is absolutely not Dante's picture, and it's not Aquinas's picture. I mean, Thomas Aquinas famously says, grace does not contradict nature, it perfects it. A very different picture from the sort of life-denying and life-rejecting puritanical forms of Christianity that tended to develop later. And then, of course, we have science and all that. Anyway, my answer really would be that I think the metaphorical and feelingful use of language precedes the literal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. We should be drawing to an end very soon. Is there any last thing you would like to say, David, about sort of what you've learned from the the several, what is it, about sort of three or four or five years that you've been working on the purgatory? What has that given you as a person?
I think the great thing that I feel has moved on, so to speak, in my own thought, is this sense of that if one's going to talk about ethics seriously, and you know, with climate change, populism, you know, there are so many troubling things in the modern world which have to do with the reckless misuse of resources, etc. So if one's going to take ethics seriously, and there's an enormous need to take it seriously today, then this idea of two levels of values is actually something extremely important, and so Dante has a quite unexpected relevance to where we are at the moment. And I think when you mentioned, Robert, that so many modernist writers, so many of the greatest modernist writers, the most serious thinkers, esteemed Dante enormously, I think it was because they intuited that he has got something which modern rationality has tended to lose, neoliberalism has tended to lose. Anyway, so that's where I go with it. I feel it's very relevant to our predicament at the moment.
Just picking up on your reference to modernist writers, as I said, it's 700 years since Dante's death. In 1965, 700 years after his birth, Anna Akhmatova gave her, was her last public performance. She died a year later. She was a sort of she was an accepted figure by then. She was no longer a persona non grata, and she took part in a big official celebration of 700 years since Dante's birth at the Bolshoi Theatre in Moscow. And in her preparatory notes for this talk, she wrote that people sometimes ask me, what do I and my two fellow acmeist poets, Nikolai Gumilyov, who'd been shot by the Soviet regime in 1921, I think, and Osip Mandelstam, who died in a labor camp in the late 30s, what do the three of us have in common? Because they are very different poets. And her answer to that was a love for Dante. I find that terribly, very, very moving. It's an extraordinary sort of gesture of loyalty, both to these two figures who've been dead for many decades, gesture of loyalty to them, and a loyalty to Dante himself. And perhaps for some of the reasons that you've just suggested. And it seems nice on this occasion of remembering the anniversary of Dante's death to also bring in the other occasion of the anniversary of his birth. So I think probably we should finish there. So thank you very, very much, both of you. It's been very, very interesting. One always sort of thinks that it's always surprising how many new things can come up in these conversations.
Well, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
Both. And thank you to everyone at the bookshop who I can't at present see on screen, but thank you, Claire and Tom, for arranging all this. And thank you to everyone whom I can't see. 117 attendees, and you will, I believe, get a link tomorrow, all of you, which will enable you to listen to this again, should you so wish. Goodbye, and thank you to everyone.
Thank you.
Goodbye. Bye, thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.